Continue on in our study then, a series of kingly lessons in 1 Samuel chapter 15. My mom told me she's taking a public speaking class and she's very nervous about it because one of the things they check her on is they set you down and ask you a question and you have to speak for 1 minute extemporaneously. You don't know what the topic is ahead of time. They call it table conversation and they count how many times you say, or so. I said, well, goodness, Mom, I've been public speaking for 20 years now, and I still use or so a lot. Yeah, that's a hard habit to break. After all, you got to fill in the dead silence with something while I'm trying to think of what to say, don't you? So, we'll count. Kim says, okay, here we go. You're going to have to take your shoes off to hit that number, I'm sure. What's that? That's good. As we pick up in chapter 15, we began it last week and, of course, didn't have time to finish everything. Oop, there was one. Finish everything. This is just going to be fun. Saul, throughout his kingship, was fighting against all of these enemies around Israel. Moabites, the Edomites in the south, southeast, the Ammonites in the east, Zobah up here to the north, Philistia over to the west on the coastal regions. And when we get to chapter 15, he's given a specific command of which enemy to go and attack, and that is the people of Amalek. God presents Saul with the case of Amalek's guilt before God, and God is going to use Israel as his instrument of judgment on the nation of Amalek. So he gives Saul the command. I recall I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. We spoke of that term, devote to destruction, as a very specific, technical sort of term that really does mean everything gets devoted to destruction. Everything is going to be destroyed. And God, just to be clear, gives him the final instruction there in verse 3. Every man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey, everything is to be put to death. That's the divine judgment upon the nation of Amalek. And while to us in modern times that seems like a harsh judgment, we were talking about this in Sunday school this morning, when Moses catches the man picking up sticks on the Sabbath day, very shortly after the law was instituted, and they find this man gathering firewood on the Sabbath. So they take him before the Lord and ask the Lord what they're to do with him. And the Lord says, put him to death. He's to die. And we, in our modern mindset, say, wow, that's a pretty steep penalty for picking up sticks. But that's not the issue, is it? It's not the picking up the sticks that's the problem. It's that he disobeyed the command. He disobeyed God's clear instructions about what to do on the Sabbath day. This is God's clear instruction to Saul. Go down to Amalek. Everything is to perish. Because Amalek had disregarded God's clear instructions regarding human life. Amalek was a violent nation. They attacked Israel when they came out of Egypt, and they continued that practice for many hundreds of years after then, so that by this point in history, God is ready to bring judgment upon them. And as the ruler of life, as the God who has created life, he has the absolute right of life and death. He's the one that says when someone lives or someone dies, and he has the right to declare that. We don't. So while we might look at it and say we don't think that is a punishment worthy of death, the issue is God is the one who gives life, and God is the one who takes it, and God has the right to decide when life begins and when it ends. And so he is absolutely within his right to declare this judgment. He sends Saul down, and Saul goes about the work somewhat wholeheartedly. Quirks, can you really say somewhat wholeheartedly? If we can use that contradiction for just a moment. Because he destroys almost everything. He goes down to Amalek. He attacks the cities. He scatters the people. Many of them flee. Everybody that he is able to get his hands on, he kills, except a certain particular person, Agag, the king of Amalek. There was a reason for that. And it was a reason that's mostly rooted in the cultural situation, that when kings defeated other kings in battle, they generally didn't kill the king. They would capture him and humiliate him in a parade through your kingdom. That was what, to us? I just said it there. Yeah. She's not even listening anymore. So, well, she's listening. She's not listening for us. That's a good thing, I guess. So Saul spares Agag, doesn't destroy him, in order that he might humiliate him and parade him through the cities of Israel and display his own kingly might to his people. He also does not destroy the best of the sheep and the oxen. And he has a reason for that, so he says. But the Lord, in verse 10 and following, appears to Samuel and tells him, "I regret that I've made Saul king. He hasn't obeyed me. Go down and tell him this." Samuel has given another message to deliver to Saul. And what is the first thing he finds? He goes out to look for Saul. He doesn't find Saul. What does he find? Here's your pop quiz that I told you was coming. He doesn't find the parade. What does he find? Eldon. Even before that, he goes out to find out where Saul is at. Ethan? A monument. And who to whom is the monument dedicated? To Saul. Saul has built a monument for himself, declaring his own mighty victories, spouting the glories of his own strength and grandeur, of this defeat over Agag. Saul's pretty taken up with himself. This is where we begin to see a transition in Saul's attitude, because at the beginning his zeal was for the Lord. He wanted to accomplish what God gave him to accomplish, but we saw some flaws in his thinking early on at Gilgal when he refused to wait for God's instructions from Samuel. And now we see that blossoming into a greater fruit as he refuses to obey God's instructions again. But now there's the underlying problem of pride is really starting to show forth. You know, you go into your garden and you look down your nice, neat rows of vegetables that you're growing, but then right off to the side, you see that little green leaf poking out. And that tells you that you've got weeds. You've got a weed there. So you either go get your hoe and chop the thing to pieces as much as you can. I saw a commercial one time with one of those cultivators. What is that? There's a real popular garden weasel. Yeah, garden weasel is the one I was thinking of. And you just roll this thing down the middle, and it's got little blades on it. It's supposed to chop up all the weeds. And it says, turn your weeds into beneficial mulch and compost. I said, I don't think I've ever known a weed to be a beneficial mulch, because if you throw them back in the dirt, they grow. Well, so I usually get down on the ground, and I'll grab that weed and rip it out. Have I told you the story of how you know the difference between a flower and a weed? Can't remember if I've told them that one. Kim says, oh, I'm not sure. She's my keeper of tall tales. The way you know a difference between a weed and your wife's prized flower, award-winning flower, if you grab a hold of it and ever so delicately pull, and it pulls it all the way out down to the very bottom root, it was your wife's prized flower. If you grab a hold of it and yank and pull and twist and turn for 2.5 hours and dig out around it, and finally it snaps off just below ground level, leaving the main part of the root in the ground, it's a weed and it'll be back next week, right? So that's how you know the difference between a weed and a flower. What's that? Yeah. Saul's got a weed in his garden, and that weed is pride. And it's starting to show itself in major ways. It's going to grow and develop into a nasty plant throughout the rest of his campaign as king, as we're going to see throughout the life of David in many different ways. Saul is beginning to think that the victory is his own, that the battles that he wins are because of his own might, and we see him declaring that in setting up this monument to himself. And Saul, or Samuel, finds out about that. He came to Carmel. This is in verse 12. Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal. He's going down to Gilgal to worship, because Gilgal is where the tabernacle is set up. If I can point you to where we're at here, this area down here is where Amalek was, and that is where the battle took place. All the way down to the west, to the borders of Egypt, Saul chased the Amalekites. Some of them got away, as we'll find out later, because the Amalekites appear again as a little thorn in the side of Israel. But as Saul is coming back up into Israel, he passed through Carmel, is down here southwest of Jerusalem. That's not the Mount Carmel that's up here. He passes through Jerusalem. He's on his way down here into the Jordan River Valley, where Gilgal is located. Gilgal's the tabernacle's location. He's heading to Gilgal for a celebratory worship feast. And if you're going to have a celebratory worship feast, what do you need to have? You've got to have lots of food, don't you? We're going to be having a nice celebratory fellowship meal at the end of the month. So, ladies and men, if you like to cook, we're going to need lots of food, aren't we? Laid out on the table for us all to eat. And cookies. So don't be afraid to make them, really. It's all good. It's all good. Saul reasons within himself, and that's what we're going to see, as he gives his excuses to Samuel. As Samuel is confronting Saul about what he did, in verse 15, Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. And the rest we have devoted to destruction." So on the one hand, we have the command given to Saul, which was devote to destruction everything, no exceptions. There were no asterisks with fine print in God's command. No exceptions, no substitutions, exchanges, or refunds. Everything was supposed to be put to the sword. And on the other side, we have Saul's carrying out, Saul's obedience to that, which in his mind, he said, there have to be exceptions. There have to be things we leave alive, because if we're going to worship God at the end of this battle and give him thanks for the victory that he gives us, then we have to have sacrifices, don't we? If we're going to celebrate this meal of worship before the Lord, then we have to have animals. Now, there were different types of offerings that were given. If you've ever read through Leviticus and understood all that's going on there, sin offerings and burnt offerings were completely consumed by fire on the altar. The priest took a portion of it for himself, but for the most part, those animals were completely destroyed upon the altar. There were thank offerings and peace offerings, which the person bringing the meal would partake of. So you would bring the animal, you would slaughter it, collect the blood, take portions of the fat and of some of the other organs, and you would burn those on the fire, but you, the worshiper, would take the rest of the animal and roast it and eat it. And that was God's program. That's what they're bringing. Thank offerings, peace offerings. Praise you, Lord. Thank you for the victory you've given us. We get to participate. We get to benefit from those offerings. And so they're bringing these offerings to the Lord, of which they're hoping to partake of in a meal. And so Saul says, hey, the people brought these so that we could sacrifice to the Lord. That's the excuse. And again, we go back to what he said at Gilgal the first time he disobeyed God's command. And he offers up this excuse of, I want to worship God by ignoring his commands. I want to serve the Lord by doing the opposite of what he told me. It would be akin to our children looking at us and saying, I want to show you honor, mom and dad, by not cleaning my room, by not washing the dishes, by not doing my chores. And all of us parents would look at the kid a little bit crosswise and say, what sense does that make? How can you honor your parents by disobeying them? And in the same way, how can you worship God by disobeying him. So in verse 16, Saul has issued his excuse after Samuel's confrontation. And Samuel finally has heard enough of this. Because look at what he says to Saul. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop." Now, how many of you in your translation that has an exclamation point? Yeah. It's because this is extremely emphatic. Samuel is not simply telling Saul to quiet down for a moment. It would be as if you said to your child who is arguing with you, "Be quiet. Stop talking. This is serious." Saul has been offering up his excuse. "Well, we were just serving the Lord. We wanted to bring the Lord something to sacrifice." And Samuel says, "Stop it. Just stop." And he's ready to rebuke Saul. He says, "I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night." This is serious. "Saul, you need to hear this, so stop." And obviously, Saul's response to him is, he stops his excuses, and he said to him, "Speak. Let me hear it. What did God tell you to tell me?" Verse 17, Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel?" This is a reference to what Saul said of himself. When Samuel anointed him and said, "You're going to be king," you remember what Saul said? He said, "Am I not of the smallest of the families, of the smallest of the tribes of Judah, of Israel?" Because Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin, which was nearly wiped out in the period of the Judges, down to just a few hundred people. And so they are a very, very small tribe. And Saul says, "Am I not an insignificant member of an insignificant family, of an insignificant tribe?" Samuel's reminding him of that and says, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel?" This is reminding Saul again of his position that God has placed him in, which we looked at the beginning of the chapter. That position of the king of Israel being the head of God's people, the leader of God's nation, and having the responsibilities of executing God's commands and judgments in the world. "The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission." He's going to remind Saul of the exact instructions, the marching orders he was given. "And said, 'Go, devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.'" There's the command, restated for Saul, because the trial is on now. Samuel is the accuser. Samuel's going to be presenting the case against Saul, and Saul's going to defend himself. So the case is, here's your responsibility. You're the king of Israel. You're supposed to be obeying God's commands and leading the nation and executing judgment against all of God's enemies. And the command was, go destroy them all. Don't leave anything. Nothing is to be spared. Man and woman, sheep and ox, camel, goat, everything is supposed to die. Verse 19, here's the question. "Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" You've got some explaining to do, Saul. Why? What could have prompted you to disregard God's command in this instance? Sadly, this isn't the first time. And it's why this is so serious, because this is evidencing a problem in the heart of Saul. Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? And that second question really has within it an understanding of the reason that Saul hasn't spoken yet. Why did you pounce on the spoil? Why do cats pounce? Well, not because they're scared. What are they chasing? A mouse. And they pounce on it to do what? Well, sometimes to play with it, right? You have several cats, right, Patricia? Do they keep your place pretty well mouse-free? Yep. So that cat pounces on that mouse, puts it under its claws. It'll play with it for a little while, but what is that cat's ultimate intention? Gonna lick my lips and we're having mouse for dinner. Kids watched this movie a little while back where the villain is a cat, and it has a pet mouse that it has named Scrumptious, and Ethan just finds that hilarious. A cat with a pet mouse named Scrumptious. Why did you pounce on the spoil? Why would you pounce on the spoil? Because you want it. And that indicates the craving that Saul had for the stuff. Saul wasn't after worship of God. Saul was after filling his own belly. Saul was after satisfying his own passions and cravings. He pounced on the spoil. Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And we have Saul's excuse, his defense of himself here. Saul says to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. Now there are times where I just want to put my hand on the head and say to somebody, you make my brain hurt. Because here's Samuel's going back and forth with Saul. Why did you disobey God? Well, we wanted to worship God. Why did you disobey God? We obeyed. We did it. Well, what's this bleating of the sheep in my ears? We did obey. And Samuel is maintaining, you didn't. There's sheep over there. The evidence is in front of you. And Saul is maintaining his innocence and saying, I did obey. And you just want to put your hand on your head and say, Saul, how can you not understand this? There's the sheep. I just gave you the command again. You received the command once before you left. I'm reminding you of what the command was, and there's the sheep. How can you possibly stand here and say, I did obey? But here's what Saul's doing. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. And here's where you really get into the fact that Saul has deceived himself regarding God and what God demands of us. Because his first sentence is, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I did go on the mission, and I brought King Agag, the king of Amalek. Saul, do you not hear what you're saying? You're maintaining that you did obey God, and yet you're pointing to the very evidence that says you didn't. Because you're saying, yeah, I brought Agag here with me. You were told to kill him. You were told to destroy everything. And as evidence of your innocence, you bring out the very thing you were supposed to destroy, and there it is, not destroyed. I did. I did obey. I brought Agag, the king of Amalek. I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. Except for Amalek, or except for Agag. And all the other ones that he missed that are going to turn up later. Saul continues to maintain his innocence, even in the face of all the evidence against him. I'm reminded of a time some years back when Kim made a chocolate cake and set it on the counter in the kitchen. We brought all the kids in and said, don't touch the cake, that's for after supper. And a little bit later, one of the children, who shall remain nameless to protect the guilty, came out of the kitchen with chocolate all over the mouth. And I looked intently at the kid. I said, did you eat some of Mommy's chocolate cake? Mm-mm. No, Dad, you told us not to touch it. I wouldn't do that. Did you eat some of Mommy's chocolate cake? Mm-mm. I didn't. I said, I'm going to give you one more chance to tell me the truth. Did you eat some of the chocolate cake that's out in the kitchen? No, Dad, I didn't. And I said, let's go into the bathroom and look in the mirror. And I picked the child up and held the child up and looked in the mirror, and the eyes grew really big. And they realized, I've been caught. Not only have I been caught disobeying the command, I've been caught lying about it. But here is Saul with chocolate all over his face, continuing to maintain his innocence. I did obey. I did go on the mission. I brought Agag. Now here's the problem with bringing Agag is that in the mind of Saul, because of what was normal in his culture, what was normal was to bring the king to demonstrate your defeat of the enemy. And so in Saul's mind, he's saying, I defeated him. I don't understand. Here he is. See, he's humiliated. He's defeated. And Samuel says, but he's supposed to be dead, not humiliated. God didn't want him humiliated. God didn't want him defeated. God wanted him dead. But Saul is so wrapped up in thinking the way all the other nations are thinking that he's not doing exactly what he's been commanded to do. How often do we bring the thinking of our world into our obedience to God? In the commands that he gives to us, how often do we say, well, you know, there's this and this. I mean, God gave us a brain to think, and we got to think about these things. Or how often do we just say, this is the command, this is where I have to do. Regardless of what everyone else is going to do, this is what I have to do. Even if it makes me look crazy in the eyes of the world. How important is obeying God's commands to us? How often do we make excuses for ourselves because we bring in the stinking thinking that we had before we were believers? I've gone on the mission. I've brought Agag, king of Amalek. I've devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But, verse 21, after maintaining his innocence, after trying to say he's done everything he was supposed to do, he's going to contradict himself again. And here's where excuses start to show themselves. Eventually, when you are believing and telling a lie, you will start to contradict yourself. And Saul's going to do that in verse 21. But the people took of the spoil, the sheep, the oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. Saul, you just said you destroyed everything, and now you're saying you didn't destroy everything. Not only are you trying to pass the buck onto someone else, so let's deal with that for just a moment. Here's the excuse. Oh, yeah, I did everything I was supposed to do. It's the people. It's their fault. I went on the mission. I destroyed everybody. I brought the king of Agag. I brought King Agag to show he's been defeated. It's all these people. It's their fault. They wanted to bring the stuff to worship. So let's dissect this for a moment, Saul. First of all, didn't God just remind you, who's the king? Well, I am. Who did God anoint to be king? Me. Then who's in charge? Well, I am. Have you ever heard the saying, the buck stops here? Saul is where the buck stops. So whose fault is it? It's got to be Saul's. He's the one in charge. He's the one that could have said, nothing comes with us. Everything dies where it stands. But he didn't. So don't try to pass the buck on the people. Secondly, they took the spoil, the sheep, and the oxen. Okay, Saul, you're contradicting yourself. You just said you destroyed everything. So first you're trying to pass the buck on to the people. Now you're contradicting your earlier testimony about your obedience. Thirdly, you're going to maintain that they brought the best of the stuff and the things devoted to destruction to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. You're going to try to really maintain that the best way to worship God is by disobeying His command? Do you see how Satan loves to turn things over on their heads? He tries to take God's commands and twist them and manipulate them and mutilate them and change definitions so that we wind up actually disobeying God while trying to obey Him. Remember the example the Lord Jesus gives when He's rebuking the Pharisees. And they say to Him, why do you disregard the laws of the elders? You don't wash your hands before you eat. And Jesus, ignoring the fact that that command was never issued by God, says, why do you guys disobey God's commands in order to obey your own? Because you say that if I dedicate something to God, that means I don't have to help my parents. So when my parents are aged and elderly and they need someone to care for them, but if I say, no, I've dedicated all my possessions to the Lord, I'm trying to act spiritual by giving everything to God, but in doing so, I have disobeyed one of God's 10 commands. Those top 10. Those 10 laws that summarize the rest of the Mosaic covenant, I'm not honoring my parents. And Jesus says, you're trying to prove yourselves to be so righteous that you're completely ignoring God's commandments. And here's where Satan likes to trip us up, that we try to convince ourselves that we're righteous people. We try to convince ourselves that we're better than everybody else and that our obedience is really, really good because we do this and this and this, and we make up our own list of things. And we don't subject ourselves to the commands that have actually been given. And there's where Saul makes that mistake. Somehow he's trying to justify saying that worshiping God with these animals is more important than doing what God told him to do. The best worship we can give is not sitting in a pew and listening to a sermon. The best worship we can give is not singing loudly when Dan leads the music. The best worship that we can give is not putting money in the offering plate. We're not saying those things are wrong. Those are part of our worship. But the best worship we can give is on Monday when we leave this building, we go out into our lives, that we obey God's commands in whatever it is we're doing this week. That's what God wants of us. He's shown you, O man, what is good. And what is the Lord required of thee? But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God. Micah 6:8. Verse 22, Samuel's going to end the debate. He's going to answer Saul's final objection about the sacrifices by this explanation of the problem in Saul's thinking. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Which one does God want? He wants obedience. Behold. Now, we've told you before, what does the word behold mean? Listen, this is important. This is something you're not expecting. Every time you see that word behold, it's to draw your attention to what is about to be said. Behold, something unusual is about to be said. Behold, Saul, here's what you don't understand. Obedience is better than sacrifice. And to listen than the fat of rams. Now, if you had been studying God's law, if Saul had been immersing himself in God's word the way that he was supposed to, he'd understand this. Who benefits from sacrifice? When you take that lamb to the altar and you cut its throat and throw the blood on the altar, who benefits from that? What's that? The sinner. I do. Does God need that blood? I need it. I need something to die in my place. But the problem was that Saul was accepting the mental picture of God that all the other nations around him had. Because their picture of their gods was that their gods needed animal sacrifices to maintain their vitality and their strength. Their conception was, you put the animal on the altar, and while it's burning, that is the God eating the life force of the animal, and he gets stronger because of it. In the same way that when we eat food, we get stronger because of it. And Samuel's going to go right to the heart of this and say, here's your problem. You don't know who God is. He doesn't need that animal. Because despite what all the rest of the world is telling you, God doesn't need the sacrifice. You do. And you need it because you've disobeyed Him. You need it because you're not holy, and He is. You need it because if you want to approach a holy God, even in worship, you have to have a substitute die in your place. Saul, you're missing the whole point because you don't understand that obedience is better than sacrifice and that listening to God is better than the fat of rams because God doesn't need that animal. You do. That animal is not going to make him stronger. That animal is not going to make him like you better. Especially when you're coming without any acknowledgement of your wrongdoing. Verse 23, rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. There is no such thing as a graduated list of sins in God's sight. We like to make those sorts of lists and say, well, you know, this sin is really bad, and, you know, this one's really bad, but this one's not quite so bad. You know, so if we talk about we talk about adultery and immorality and homosexuality, those things are really bad. Murder, yeah, that's one of those top really bad ones. If we're going to talk about gossip and slander and enmity, those things, that's all right. We can get away with that. And we may not say that vocally, but we act like it. And Samuel brings down the hammer on that kind of thinking and saying, no, it's all the same. Rebellion is the same as what God calls the abomination of divination. So disregarding any of God's commands is the same as if I had gone down to the soothsayer and tried to get my fortune told. Presumption, thinking I know better than God, is the same as if I had bowed down and worshipped an idol, because you know what? I did. And what was the idol? Myself. I thought I knew better than God. I thought I could tell God what He didn't know. I said, well, God, you know, you gave me this command, but what you're really not thinking about is all this stuff. You really want to tell God He hasn't thought something through? You really want to tell God that His way isn't going to work? You really want to tell God you tried and it didn't work the way He said it would? You call Him a liar? Presumption is the same as idolatry. Here's the condemnation that God brings against Saul, last part of the verse. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, He has also rejected you from being king. Now, several chapters ago, Saul was told, your dynasty has been rejected. Your house will not endure. So Saul already knew that his dynasty would not continue indefinitely in Israel, but now he's being told he himself is being rejected from the kingship in Israel. He himself, his kingdom, is going to come to an end. It's a bitter, bitter pronouncement. Especially when Samuel is in the position of telling the nation, I told you so. You're going to want to put a king in place, but unless he's the kind of king that is willing to obey God wholeheartedly, without reserve, without question, you're going to be no better off than you were under the judges. In fact, you might be worse off. And now they're going to begin to see the results of having that kind of king in place, because God has uttered His judgment. Saul, you're no longer my king. You're no longer the one that I want on this throne. Saul's going to be on that throne for a little while, probably another 10 to 12 years. And we're going to find out what the kingdom becomes under Saul when he's finally been rejected and displayed through these disobediences that his heart is not wholly sold into obeying God. We'll have to cover the rest of the chapter next week. So Wanda, I'll try to make sure to send you an updated list for next Sunday evening. Any questions or comments as we finish out? All right. Let's go ahead and go to